This is the No Limits Podcast, number one. And I'm talking this morning with Tim Travis, who is from downtheroad.org. And it's all about his cycling adventures that began in 2002 and have continued to the present and going into the future. So good morning, Tim. And how are you this morning?
Good morning. Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Right. So I should say, where are you this morning?
Well, we're currently taking a break in Indiana, USA, and working on our third book, but we just bought our airline tickets to fly to India in March.
Okay, excellent. So do you want to tell us a little bit about, well, we can talk about your books. Do you want the current book that you're working on? What are the topics that you're covering there?
Well, the books are all about our trip so far. And the first book goes from Arizona to Panama. The second book goes from Quito, Ecuador, down through South America. And now the third book picks up where we landed in Bangkok and goes through Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam.
Oh, right. Excellent. Okay, and so how would listeners be able to find all the books and everything?
The easiest way is just go to downtheroad.org and scroll down a little bit, and you won't miss it. We have the books on the website all over.
Okay, cool. All right, so we'll get into that some more. Now you've been traveling on bikes and not living, obviously, not living permanently anywhere. For quite some time now. Actually, how many years are we talking now?
In March, it'll be 8 years.
Okay, right. So how is that? Are you enjoying that aspect of being? Would you describe yourself as a nomad?
Yeah, I think at this point we're nomadic. And definitely I enjoy it, but it doesn't seem like we're on a trip anymore. It just seems more like we live nomadically or we live on the road. So it doesn't seem so special like that anymore.
Right. Okay, so let's start off with in regards to bicycle adventures. This is very general, but what are 10 things that everyone should remember to bring on a bicycle adventure? What do you think are the most essential 10 items if you had in your panniers on your bike?
Well, you need a sleeping bag and a tent and a mattress, and you need a way to fix a flat tire, which is a number of things, but you need all the gear to fix a flat tire. And let's see, if you're camping a lot, you need a stove and you need pots and pans. And I'd have to get my equipment list out.
all right, that's okay. Hey, with the flat tires, what do you think is the best way to avoid getting a flat tire?
Don't ride your bike. No, seriously. Having new tires helps a lot, and keeping your tires pumped up to the proper pressure helps a real lot.
And
avoiding glass and things on the road.
Mm-hmm. Scanning the road, watching out for objects. What do you consider the proper air pressure? Like, I guess it depends on the weight of the bike and also the how your panniers are set up and weights distributed. But what do you think on average, like for a man or a woman, what would be the average for an adult that would be carrying the full kit?
Well, it depends on what's written on the side of the tires. We use a 26. By 1.75 tire, and it takes 70 psi. But if you can have smaller, higher pressure tires, or even bigger.
Okay, right. That sounds the same. I've got those on my mountain bike as well. I use the Schwalbe. I'm just using the standard Schwalbe Marathon.
Right. We've used all different kinds of brands of tires. We usually buy them in a bike shop as we go.
Okay.
I don't really put much stock in between one brand of tire to the other. I have like five that I like and that I look for. And if I can't find those, I'll look for the next best thing. But they're all, if you buy a $50 tire or a $30 tire, they're all about the same.
Okay. So with comparing tires then, you don't think there's much difference between one and the other? Like, Like, you know, when you, the Schwalbe, is it Schwalbe? Am I
Yeah,
saying it right?
I've had several of those, and I don't know how to pronounce it either.
I'll go with Schwalbe. So the Schwalbe Marathon or Marathon XR, I guess the Marathon XR, I believe the one with the, it's got a bigger kind of a mountain biking, it's got an edge or a bite on the tread. The Marathon is pretty slick. It's got the sort of internal tread, the tread that goes inward. What do you think? I mean, I like you said, they're all very similar.
I've used them. I've gotten flats with all of them. I've worn all of them out. There's those two, and there's the Continental Top Touring and the Continental Travel Contact. For the money, if you're on a tight budget, the Vittoria Randoneers are pretty good for the money, but
Okay.
no tire will prevent a flat few from getting a flat. I think that's what a lot of people are hoping for when they buy a tire. And some people
Right.
will go on a 2 month trip and say, "Oh, I never got a flat. These are the best tires in the world." But in the end, 2 months is not going to really give you a flat tire. We maybe average a flat a month, but not if our tires are brand new. We can go 3 months without a flat and then start getting a flat a month after that. So
Okay, right. So the tire softens. Does it soften up or just thin out or?
it gets thinner, I think. And the sun and everything may dry rot it too. And just getting thin, and you know your tires are getting worn out because you start getting more and more flats.
Right. Have you ever tried I don't know if this is really effective. It's like an experiment that I came up with, but taking tubes, like taking old tubes and cutting them and then wrapping your inner tube in the tire, like, and then remounting it, you know, pumping it up so the tube itself kind of stretches out, but you've got that lining. I don't know, again, maybe that's not really that effective, but I've experimented with it in Korea and I've had some success.
Well, they make a thing called Mr. Tuffy, which is a tire liner like you're trying to achieve. But the problem with
Oh,
adding anything to your tire is that it adds weight. And any rotating weight, like a gram of weight in your wheels, is worth, I've heard, 4 grams on your frame. So any bit of little weight on your wheels really adds up.
well, you're right, and I have noticed the balance of doing it. Like the strip that I cut was not exactly symmetrical, but I eyeballed it and I cut it and put it in there. I wrapped it from end to end around the tube. But I find that in the front wheel, now again, it worked. Like I was using just regular, smaller, hybrid tires, and I was getting like many, many flats here. But I wrapped it on there, and it was good. Narrow tires, the really small kind of, hybrid style, 700C, I guess. I'm not sure the exact diameters. 1.5, or because we were talking about the 26 inchers with the 1.75 width, so they're much narrower than that. But I found it was effective. But this tire, the 26 inch tire, I did the exact same experiment, and the front wheel I found had a it created a wobble. It creates a like the balance is off, or the I don't know the the way it wraps around the rim, it's almost like the tire is not seated exactly the same all the way around. And I've cut it, I've trimmed it back, but again, that's when I'm finding it. Downhill, I'll feel a wobble in that tire because of that.
Well, another thing you might try is just slime. If we're ever traveling through an area where there's a lot of thorns and stuff, I'll use slime if I can find it.
Oh, right. Okay. Now, what is slug? It's like green slime or
Yeah,
green.
slime's a brand name, I think. I think the tire sealant. But if something goes through your tube, it'll seal up the hole.
Okay. So you fill it up and it runs like it's always in your tube and
Yeah, the
kind
tech shop will be able to help you with that. But yeah, it goes in your tires and then it's like a gel that's inside of your tube. And when something
right.
goes through it, and it does a pretty good job of sealing it up, but the downside is it's weight and you do feel that weight.
Okay, right. I wonder, what about tubeless tires? Are they making touring bikes that have, can you go with the option of tubeless? Because I've heard that the tire pressure is really like quite high, like 115, you know, and 120 psi. What do you think about that?
With tubeless tires is something I really don't know anything about, and I would be interested if one of your listeners could tell me if that's an option, because I've never had them or seen them or messed with them. So they'd be, if it works out that you could use tubeless tires and never get a flat again, I'd be very interested in that.
Okay. Okay, cool. All right, let's get back to the road. And maybe you can describe or give a little intro to two of the books that you currently have available. The first is The Road That Has No End. That was the beginning of your tour, and then later when you continued on, you guys finished, you and Cindy finished writing the book Down the Road in South America. So could you give a little bit of a background on the two books, and then perhaps you know, explain more about the formats that are available? Because I know you have an e-book, and then you have your print version of the books available as well.
Well, The Road That Has No End, our first book, goes into big detail about how we saved up the money to go on the trip. And at this time, we thought it'd be a seven-year trip. And how I talked my wife, Cindy, into doing it. And how we went from living in a house, and I was a teacher, and Cindy was a geologist, and we had careers. And how we went from that to being on the road with just our bikes. And it's quite a thing. Now, that whole first chapter of what I just described is online for free on our website. And if you poke around, you'll find that and the rest of the books in the printed version. And the second book, so the first book starts with that, and then we take off from Arizona where we were living, and we went all the way to Panama City, Panama, in that book. And then the second book picks up in Quito, Ecuador, and goes south. But the interesting thing about the second book is it talks a lot about how the idea of writing the first book came about. And because it's still at that time, we had a limited amount of money and a limited amount of time for the trip. And the second book goes into real detail about, well, we can invest like 4 or 5 years worth of money into maybe making this thing go forever or go indefinitely. So right. The second book goes through a lot of that decision process of, do we risk it? Do we risk sinking our money into a book and with the possibility of winning and going forever, or the possibility of losing and having to go home?
Wow. So there's a big gamble in a way.
It was a huge
how gamble. You're going to keep going and accomplishing your mission. Eh?
Yeah, we don't really have a mission. We like to say our goal is not to have a goal. And our trip is not very goal-driven. But we want to accomplish seeing the world. I mean, not having a goal is pretty hard.
Yeah, it'd be impossible. Right,
see as much of the world as we can and as slowly as we can do it as possible.
Okay. Well, here's another topic that's, I guess it's a bit of a comparison, but what you're doing is you know, world touring. And the other attempt that's been done recently, and it's in the Guinness book, is circumnavigation. Now, some do it, you know, at leisure, and others have done it to get in the Guinness book and, you know, set a world record. What do you think about the two? Like, what would be, I don't know, the desirable aspect of world touring as opposed to trying to go through the circumnavigation route? And is circumnavigation not even close to world touring? What's your impression of that?
Well, the difference, I've never thought about this, but the difference between world touring and circumnavigation, I guess, is if you're world touring, you're just sort of meandering throughout the globe, not necessarily going around it or trying to cover any certain distance.
Right.
If you're
if the circumnavigation, when I look at the route, they'll go, you know, across, you know, they'll go across Europe. It's kind of like starting in, you know, Western Europe, and then they go across through the Middle East and, you know, India, and then Southeast Asia. And then I'm not sure if the route goes through Indonesia, but and then it just drops to, you know, Australia and then perhaps New Zealand. And then they go around, and then you're back on the west coast of North America, and they just cross America. And I believe that's it. So it really misses out on a lot of other places. So
yeah, I think the goal of circumnavigating for speed record is it's just that. It's like a great big time trial, the biggest time trial ever invented. And then world touring, at least by my definition, is just when you're out to have a good time and see things and things like that. That doing it for a speed record is something I admire and something I respect, but not anything I'd ever want to attempt or do or even pay much attention to.
Right. What's I guess here's another good question. What would you say? What's the least kilometers that you've traveled in a day? If you can, I don't know if you can recall that. You've had many days on the road.
No,
But
I
what
can
would you
remember
say
once in
would be least?
Ecuador. I can remember once in Ecuador, we rode like 8 kilometers, and Cindy wasn't feeling well, so we pulled over. And I remember another time in, I think, China, we only rode like 10 kilometers, and then a man invites us in. We don't really care how far we go in a day. If someone invites us in the house, we'll go in the house because we're not out to do this to ride a bike. We're out to do this to meet people and learn their languages and religions and customs and cultures. So the bike part is just sort of in the background, and we just want to be immersed in the cultures and learn about the world. It's very educational what we do, and not near as
Yeah,
athletic
that's a
as.
great approach. Okay, so here's the next question, and it kind of ties in good with talking about languages and talking about new cultures. With your experience on a bicycle, in foreign environments, how does it shape you and the people you meet down the road?
Well, for us, it's made us very international, which is a fair leap for the average American is to think international terms. And it's made us real accepting and tolerant of every religion and culture and ways of life. It's made us look at the world as one place, almost like one country, as opposed to a
Right.
bunch of little countries.
Right. So in experiencing and seeing these different locations and cultures, which one do you think you could call home if you were not living in the United States? Let's say you went to maybe another one of these destinations. Which place do you think you'd like to spend the most amount of time?
Well, we talk about that in terms of where would we retire. So not so much what's the next closest culture to what I grew up in America. That would be Canada. But and then after that, maybe Australia and New Zealand and UK and so on. But as far as the place I'd like to retire, we really like Mexico a lot, and we like Argentina a lot. I like Latin American cultures because it's not so different from what we do, such as Asia is. And it's nice to be in the same time zone as North America, so we can call home and things. And there's just odd advantages like that to Latin America. I like the food too.
So here's another one about, well, actually, we're talking about Latin America or South America in this case. Colombia, I've heard mixed stories about Colombia. I know recent cyclists have been through there doing the WT, doing the World Tour. Are there any dangers in traveling through these places? Like, what do you think? Are there hot spots in South America?
Well, Colombia has changed since we've been down there. When we were down there, they were kidnapping, I think, 3,000 foreigners a year. Since then, I think the civil war in Colombia has settled down, and I know a lot of people are going through now with without any problems. And if we were going through now, we'd probably do it. There's always hot spots. Latin America has hot spots, but it's been a few years since we've been through, and it's probably changed from the hot spots we knew of in our time.
Okay, good. Fair enough. Let's see. Do you want to talk a little bit about bike parts and durability? I think you probably have been through a few chains and tires along the way. How long do you think I should expect each different bike part to last? So if you, I don't know which part you want to talk about, but
Well,
what.
okay, in a nutshell, and it all depends on how heavy you are, how heavy your bike is, how much mountains you do, but all that aside, I can speak from my own experience because I'm fairly heavy and I carry a big load, and we prefer the mountains over the flats. So get all that,
right.
All that given, a rear tire will last me about 6 months. A front tire will last me about 12 months. And I think that's wearing them out pretty fast. But like I said, I'm heavy and all my stuff's heavy. The derailleurs, I don't tend to wear out, but you need jockey pulleys probably every 12 months. Chains I replace as often as I can, but at least every 6 months, if not every 4 months. If you every chance I see a bike shop where I can buy a chain, if I'm abroad, if I'm not in North America or Australia or somewhere
right.
like that, I would buy a chain. So if I was biking from Canada to South America, I'd probably buy a chain at least in Mexico, because bike shops are pretty plentiful there. Because
okay.
some countries are hard to find. The front derailleur, I don't know if I've ever worn a front derailleur. You just bring cables, because when you wear a cable out, you'll know it'll snap. Latin America is pretty good for bike shops, because they're into biking, the Latin Americans. They like to race and everything. So
okay.
it's not so hard to find a bike shop as opposed to maybe like China.
Right. What kind of bike shops do you see down there? Are they the same as North American bike shops? Like they have racing bikes and like the same variety of parts and everything? Do you find it's pretty much universal?
Well, it depends on if you're in the big city. Like we went to a bike shop in Guatemala City. They have everything the same. But if you're in a small village or something, it may be just for single-speed bikes. So there's always a good bike shop in the capital cities. Latin America is full of velodromes. And if a city has a velodrome, then you know they have good bike shops. That's kind of one thing you can go on. If they host a major race, you'll know they have good bike shops, like the Tour of Costa Rica or Tour of Colombia, things like that. You know they're going to have better bike shops. But like when I was in Guatemala, I'd been a rim. And about the only place I knew to fix it was Guatemala City. And in a city of 10 million people, there were two good bike shops, and they were both fairly near the velodrome.
Oh, wow, okay. I never thought, I know about velodromes. I never really thought much about them. I know they do, you know, it's like a special style of racing in.
Yeah, it's
so
usually that part of town. It's not so much that they just sell track bikes, but usually that part of town you can buy. Like I did, I bought a mountain bike rim, and I had a guy build it, and everything was up to snuff. I mean, it's Shimano bike parts in the better shops all over the world, Shimano and SRAM and Campagnola. That's pretty standard. So bikes are very international in that regard, in that they're pretty interchangeable for stuff.
Okay, excellent. That's really good. What about, I guess that those are the main, what about bottom brackets? What do you think? Are those common to fail on bikes, or
it depends on what kind you get. There's several styles of Shimano bottom brackets. I like, and we're sponsored by Phil Wood, so the Phil Wood bottom brackets will last virtually forever, and every now and then we'll have them serviced for free. The Shimano bottom brackets that have internal sealed cartridge bottom brackets, so the new style ones will probably last you a year or 2 years. They're pretty good nowadays.
Right. What's the big factor that's different about Phil Wood's bottom brackets?
It's just a higher quality, and it's a sealed mechanism, and that they guarantee them in that you can mail things to them, and they'll service them and mail them back to you.
Okay. Oh, wow. How long is that guarantee? Like when you have that, like if you buy a new bottom bracket.
Well, my relationship with Phil Wood is different, but I believe they guarantee for life.
Okay, right.
For everybody, it's a great company to work with, and we've been sponsored by them for several years. And all I have to do is mail it to them, and they send it back.
Wow. Fantastic. Okay. Great. Okay. So sounds like a lifetime guarantee. Kind of reminds me of Tilly Endurables. Have you ever had a Tilly hat before?
Well, if I ever see someone wearing a Tilly hat, I almost assume they're Canadian. I have not had a Tilly hat. My brother's very proud of his because he likes to go fishing. And my dad has a Tilly hat for years because he likes to go fishing. But I think they bought them fishing in British Columbia.
Oh, wow, right. Yeah, that I mean, I'm sure they definitely send you a hat. Now, I don't know how well it would work with, you know, cycling helmets and stuff. And actually, it's funny on that topic. What's your, well, I know you probably will tell most people to be safe, wear a cycling helmet. Some cyclists that are, kind of doing explorations, they don't want to wear a helmet on world tours. What's your impression on that? Are people crazy not to wear a helmet?
Well, I'm pro-choice when it comes to helmet wearing. I don't really care if people wear them or not. I like a helmet because it's not so much for the protective nature of the helmet, but it's a hat that I can strap onto my head and it keeps the sun off my head and yet lets the air breathe through my head. So even if the helmet wasn't protective, I'd probably still wear it just to keep the sun from beating down on my head and the air blowing through my head.
Right. Okay, cool.
And it doesn't hurt that it keeps your brains from getting smashed out on the pavement.
Yeah, I'm pretty big on helmets, yeah. So we're talking about touring, going to different countries, and of course, you've mentioned sightseeing, like getting out there and really getting a taste of what's happening around you. And I've done the motorcycle touring in the past, and I did find myself with panniers, things I couldn't lock down. How is it with bike touring when you carry the panniers and you have all your equipment and everything? How can you separate yourself, or can you separate yourself from the bike when you're out there to experience some other things when you're on your trip?
Well, okay, there's different scenarios. So if you're free camping and you're hidden completely from everybody, we'll leave the bags on our bikes, put the tent up, not worry about it. Because if nobody can see you, then you don't have much of a security problem. If we're camped in a campground and it seems to be near a city or, you can just tell when things are bad, we may very well put every bag we have inside the tent. And then at night we zip the tent up and then we lock the bikes to a tree. And then if you're in a developing country, you just get a hotel room and you put your bikes and your stuff in the room, lock the room, and then you can go walking around without your stuff.
Oh wow, okay. Okay, so carry a very large lock with you then. Is it hard to carry all the locks? Do you carry multiple like small ones and big ones, or?
It depends on the continent we're touring. Like if we were touring North America or Australia, New Zealand, Europe, we carry two pretty good, they're combination cable locks that we can hook together. Because often you're locking our bikes to a tree and we have two bikes. And since there's two of
Okay.
us, we figure we can have two locks. And it's nice that you can string them together and make one very long lock. So you can lock all your wheels and I run it through my seat and all kinds of stuff like that.
Right.
When we go to India, I'll probably scale down to a much smaller lock because you're just never locking your bike up on the street would be kind of crazy in a
Right.
developing world. And usually you're just locking it up at worst in the lobby of a hotel, but usually it's in the room and I'll even lock our bikes in our room. I'm fairly paranoid about things getting robbed. So I like to say I'm not racist. I don't trust anybody.
Right, across the boards, yeah. Yeah, even in your hotel. Do you ever think you might be a target going into a hotel? I don't know if people like you like you said, you go out and roam around. Do you think there's a chance that somebody could go into the room and actually take the bikes, or is that really unlikely?
It hasn't happened to us, the bikes, before. There has been occasions where I've been sitting in the room. I'm thinking of Thailand, and Cindy went to brush her teeth, and people will wait for you to leave the room thinking that you're alone. And when you go in, let's say there's a shared bathroom down the hall. So you go down the hall to brush your teeth. As soon as Cindy left, and I was sitting there reading a book, somebody came in the room thinking that there was nobody in the room. So my advice is if that is a dangerous time when you leave to go brush your teeth or leave to go to the bathroom because you think, oh, I'm leaving for a couple minutes and I'll just be back and I don't want to bother with locking my room. But to me, that's a very important time to lock your room. Even if you're just going down to use the bathroom down the
Right.
hall, lock your room.
Right. Good point, actually. Excellent point.
Another point to that, if I can add, is no
Sure.
matter what country we're in, if it's the US or it's Cambodia, and we have a hotel room, which isn't so often in the US, but that's if we did have a room, we tell them not to clean it unless we're there. If I'm present, they can clean it. But if I'm not present, we just tell them we don't want our room clean, don't go in. Just like I said, we just are not trusting. And that includes my own country.
Right, right. Well, that's good. Yeah, a good point. Be there to see, you know, what's happening. Because what do you think would be common or the quickest things to lose in your gear? What, or even just cycling down the road? Have you ever left a bag on, like, one of the panniers undone, or something fell off? Is it common to lose things, or?
Well, it's very common to lose things. I haven't really lost something out of the bag, but it's more like you park the bikes, you go into a restaurant with your guidebook or a map, and you leave that behind. Or if you're in a hotel room and you pack up and you forgot that you put something on a shelf or somewhere and you leave that behind. We have lost far more things than have ever gotten stolen. We've only been robbed once, and that was in Vietnam. And that we're writing that whole story up in the book now. But it was from a cleaning lady who we asked not to clean the room, and she went in anyway. The thing about cleaning people is that they can't just take your laptop or your bike, because you're going to notice that right away. I believe what they typically will do is look for your money and try to take some of it so you don't notice.
Right, right. Put a small dent, yeah, a small dent in the cash.
So you don't know, that was I out drinking and spent that money, or did I lose that, or, you know. You have to carry quite a bit of U.S. currency when you're traveling, because sometimes it's 3 days before you can get to a bank machine or something like that. So you may have $500 in $10 bills on you. And if they find that, they'll, you know, look at taking a third of that, hoping you don't notice.
Oh, wow. So actually, that's an interesting topic there too, with currency and carrying money. In the past, when I've done, you know, some traveling, of course, most of mine's continental, in the U.S. or in Canada, but I always have traveler's checks. When you're on these big tours, you go down to these other countries, American traveler's checks, not a good idea? Or?
I think they're still a good idea. We don't do it because of the big fees people charge to cash them. What we do is we have two separate ATM cards, and we have separate credit cards, and then we'll have a fair amount of local currency, and then hidden deep in our bag somewhere, we'll have a big stack of U.S. money for emergencies.
Right. So again, another one for protecting the panniers and keeping that bike in your hands.
Right.
Okay.
We've been in places where we thought, you know, gosh, we could be robbed and standing here in just our bike shoes and helmets. What would we do? In that case, you know, you can hide a credit card and some currency in your shoes.
Oh, right. Okay.
Now, we've never had that happen. We've never been robbed on the road. We've had friends who have, if you know the story of Pat and Kat in Peru.
Okay.
I don't know their website, but they're Bicycle Boomers or something like that. It's a really good website, but they were robbed at gunpoint in the daytime, and I forget what they were left with, but, you know, that kind of bothered us. But that would be for a country like Guatemala or, you know, possibly Peru or somewhere like that, not just anywhere.
Okay. I think in your book, The Road That Never Ends, or actually it may have been Down the Road in South America, I believe it was The Road That Never Ends. Your experiences in Mexico.
It's The Road That Has No End, but okay.
The Road That Has No End, sorry. When you were down in Mexico, did you come across many, provincial or these border checks? I've done a road trip down there. I was down there for about a month. This is probably about 10 years ago. But I do remember that sometimes local people will set up sort of a checkpoint. Did you find things like that when you were on the pedal bikes?
Yes, I think I know what you're talking about, where you're riding along and the locals have strung a rope across the road and they want you to pay a toll.
Right, right. Yeah, I had that. I was actually driving with a friend.
We've come across that three different times, and there's stories of that in both of the books, and that is a very tense time, because it's one thing to be driving where you can crack the window, give them 10 pesos, and move on. It's another thing to be on your bike and have to pull your wallet out, which we didn't. it's quite a story of how we get past those. But you don't want to stop, and I don't mind giving them a little bit of money if it made it all go away, but I don't think it would happen. Because we're on the bikes, we're outside, and these people are usually been drinking, and they want drinking money. So really drunk people often scare me, and they string across the road, a rope across the road, and they can be pretty belligerent. I've had quite a few stories happen with that. And
Right, right.
what we do is just put our heads down and get to a full sprint and hope they drop the rope.
Oh, wow, okay. So you crash the gates every time usually? Or have you ever stopped or usually just keep pedaling on through?
Years ago, I was traveling. I was on a solo trip, but I'd hooked up with a man from Austria, and we were in Chiapas, Mexico. And this is long before I met Cindy or anything. This is when I used to be young and single. And we got
Right.
stopped in the real back country of Chiapas, and we actually stopped, and we were trying to reason with them, and they were very, very drunk. And a guy came out and actually hit me over the head with a machete. And started to grab
Wow.
the other guy, but I had my helmet on. See, I guess that's another odd way to wear a reason to wear a helmet. He didn't
God.
hit me with the sharp end. He kind of turned the machete
The blunt.
sideways, so I think he was more wanting to scare me than kill me. But
Oh,
after that is when I decided I don't ever want to stop when they pull the rope across the road.
right, wow. Yeah, that's intense. Yeah, and on the bikes, I for some reason, do you think, I mean, you're right, these people are belligerent and they're drunk. But in general, other people, how do people react to you, coming through their town or whatnot on bikes? Like, how is the world receiving people, cyclists that are touring? Do you
Well,
find it's
when I talk about these ropes across the road, that is very rare and not the norm. Like I said, it's happened to me 3 times in almost 8 years. Most people, when we ride into the village, are very excited about us coming, and we've had whole schoolyards empty out just so they can watch us, and the teacher let them talk to us and things like that. Most people in the world are just wanting to raise their kids, do their thing, live an honest life. And when you come into their village, they know you're from a foreign place, and they're very interested and very generous with you.
Right, wow, that's good to hear, right? Good to hear. Hey, if we could step back a minute, we were talking about camping, and of course, this is a good way to sustain the touring, keep it going for a long period of time. How do you find the free camping?
All right, the free camping is always a bit of a trick because when you camp without any facilities, you need to be hidden, and you also need water. Water is the big determining. And seldom is the free place to camp with water. Now, if you're up in northern Canada or coming down through Alaska or in southern Argentina, then no problem. You can camp next to a river. We have a water filter, or we boil water, no problem. But most places, if you're going to camp for free, it's not going to have a water source. So there's the big limiting factor. So we have a bag that holds 10 liters of water. I think that's 2.5 gallons. You can
Oh, wow.
buy at a camping store. And when we go far enough and we're ready to say let's pull over soon, the first town we come to, I'll fill that bag full of water and tie it to the back of the bike, and then we'll ride on after that. And the first place we can find where we can hide, we'll camp for free.
Wow. Okay, so when you do that, like you said, you find a place and you can hide. Now, are you doing all this in the dark? Are you doing it late at night or
No,
when?
it's the other hard thing with free camping is I think it shortens your day some because you may ride an hour after you pick up water, you may ride more. So it's almost like when you free camp, you have to have a three-quarter day. That gives you enough flexibility to set up and everything and find a good place to camp.
Right. Now, what about having a campfires? Like, do you avoid doing that when you're doing free camping? Obviously, you don't want to be detected. Just get the tent set up and have it low impact. Maybe get your stove out and cook. Because I've done the motorcycle touring and I've kind of done what you were talking about off of interstate highways or, back roads if I can find them where there's farms or countryside. But I've never had I don't think I've ever had an open fire. So, can you still enjoy open fires and stuff when you're doing that, the sort of stealth camping?
Well, if you're out in the middle of the forest, yes. But generally, if you're camping near people or on someone's yard, then a fire would be bad because you're going to be spotted and kind of rude. If you're camping on someone's property, you don't want to risk their property to a fire. So for the two
Right.
things, it's visible and I think it's kind of rude.
But what about the is there like is that the danger though? Is it like you have a fire, let's say you, I don't know, maybe somewhere in the back country of Mexico, like northern the Baja Peninsula or something, in the desert. If you're out there and there's not really anyone around, but it's still, could that be a factor, like a danger factor, drawing, people from distances, they see somebody out there?
It could be. If you're camping, I mean, it all depends on where you are. So if you're camping wild in Mexico, but you're in the middle of the desert, you probably want to keep a low profile because you don't want everyone driving down the road knows somebody's camping over there. But if you're in Colorado and you're just pulled over at the National Forest, you can go ahead and have a fire. For one, it's legal, and for two, you don't have as many crazy people driving by, and they would probably assume you're armed.
Right. Okay. Okay, I'm gonna get on to another topic. Talking about health, being a cyclist, obviously, I don't know if you want to talk about the meals you eat, but what kind of fuel do you use to keep yourself rolling? And also, what happens when you have some health concerns on the road? Are there ways to manage that, to make situations easier to get through?
Well, what we eat always greatly depends on what country we're in. If you're in the developing world, usually it's so cheap to eat out, and if you're in an urban-ish area, you eat out most meals, and you tend to eat what a truck driver eats in that country. If you're crossing the U.S. or you're in Australia or somewhere where it's more expensive and you can't eat out every meal or even most meals, then we would have a lot of oatmeal in the morning, and you'd be surprised how many countries you can find oatmeal. And then we
Right,
might
that.
make sandwiches for the afternoon, either out of peanut butter or avocado or Vegemite or Nutella. It all depends on what they do in each country. And then for dinner, you can always buy stuff like a hamburger, or you can make canned soup or pasta or something like that. But really, the trick to traveling in these countries cheaper is to eat and live like the locals do. So if I'm coming
Right.
across Canada and I know they like peanut butter and oatmeal, then I live, eat that. And if I'm in China, you learn to eat a lot of rice and stir-fry stuff. And if I'm in Argentina, you learn to eat empanadas and things like that. And in Mexico, you learn the street vendors who sell tacos.
Okay. That sounds like a good, so it sounds like the meals are abundant, they're everywhere. Now, what about, actually, I was just thinking about when you cook your own meals, what do you find is the easiest to carry? When you talk about weight saving and maybe having a large enough meal, what types of food do you think, are the best to carry with you?
Well, I wish Cindy was here because that's really her department, but she was busy today.
What about,
But I can tell you, there's a list of vegetables which are you can carry. Now, this is
okay.
assuming you're not in a country where you can eat out for 50 cents a meal. But if I'm riding across Canada or the U.S. or whatever, I think it's broccoli and cauliflower and cucumber and carrots and some onions and garlic. You can kind of imagine, like, tomatoes are hard to carry.
Right, they're gonna get mashed, yeah.
It can be done, and we often carry them, but they're harder and they don't last as long in your bag. So if you kind of
Right.
think of it that way, what can you buy that you can smush up a little bit? And that list of vegetables I gave you is a partial list of things that are pretty easy to carry. And then you can, whatever you can boil water and make, so pasta and,
Have you ever experimented with the freeze-dried food? And I know it's not, like you said, you probably eat local foods, but have you ever experimented with that?
We did a backpacking trip once in the Grand Canyon where we bought a lot of that. The problem with that is it's very expensive.
Right, yeah.
So it's not a
That
long-term
might be it.
solution. If I was going to be carrying a backpack or I was going to do a really hard, long, desolate stretch, then the freeze-dried option would come into play. But the meals are quite expensive.
Okay, right. Yeah, so not a practical solution for a cyclist cycle tour.
Now, on the other hand, we do keep a couple freeze-dried meals. If we're in a country where we're camping a lot, we do keep a couple freeze-dried meals and some other light, dry things in the bottom of a bag, just in case you get somewhere and the store is closed, or a mouse gets in your other food, or just in case there's an emergency, we always have about one or two meals of emergency food that can last for months in the bottom of the bag without any problems.
Right. what do you think about carrying? Now, this varies country to country, and maybe not common for most tourists, but things like pepper spray. You talk about like having something. What is a cyclist's personal protection? I mean, other than standing up and or trying to run away from a situation like you've described, like these border checks and things that maybe locals will set up. Have you ever like considered that an option to carry pepper spray? And I know up in the north, like if we're talking about Alaska or Northwest Territories, Yukon, a lot of people have bear spray. And I know that's not legal in many states or provinces. So what do you think about that? Is that a necessary option, or should that not be carried?
Well, we carried pepper spray with us through a lot of Latin America and never used it. But it kind of makes you feel better to have it. When we were in Alaska and coming down through the Yukon and British Columbia, we had bear spray. We never had to use it, but boy, I would never travel up there without it because I don't know. You want some sort of last defense if a bear is bothering you. It's not so hard going between the US and Canada with bear spray. I don't, I may try flying to India with it. They may take it. I don't know how the bear spray works at borders, but I do like the bear spray and I do like having something with us as a pepper spray. I don't carry a gun or anything like that.
Right. Yeah, the pepper. Well, is it bear spray? It's basically a stronger or a bigger canister of pepper spray, right?
Yeah, it looks like a little fire extinguisher, and I've never even squirted mine, thank goodness. I've seen it
Right.
squirt. If you look on YouTube, you can see what it looks like when it squirts, which is a good idea if you're going to carry it, so at least to have some idea what that's going to look like coming out.
Right. That's a
It
good
squirts pretty
idea, yeah.
far, and it's you know, if you, next to a gun, I think it's one of the better things you can carry. What I like about it is I'm very passive, and it's not going to hurt anybody permanently. And I like
Right.
that.
It is very right.
I don't think I could ever point a gun at somebody and pull the trigger. I'm just not my way. Or even take a knife out and cut somebody. But if somebody was messing with us, I wouldn't hesitate about spraying them down with that because it's not permanent.
Right. We skipped through a little bit. We talked about food, which is really good. You did a great job covering it. Tim, what do you think about situations where you get sick? Is it difficult to get medical treatment and help? And have you ever had a crash or any type of road injury where it took you out for a while?
Well, that's an interesting idea, is that getting sick, if you can get to a doctor, that's great. And then if you can afford the doctor, the worst place probably to get sick is the United States because it's so expensive to see the doctor here.
Right.
If we got sick here and if at all possible we could wait, I would fly to India and then see the doctor there. So if the biggest wreck I ever had was in Peru. They have pretty good doctors. The level of medical care throughout the world is fairly standard if you seek out the better doctors in town.
Right.
So
What happened down the road in Peru? What can you describe? Sounds like you're on a mountain or something. Were you on a mountain terrain, or is it a paved road?
it was a dirt road. It was going down 3,000 meters of descending, which I think is 10,000 feet. And I wish it was a big, glorious story. but we weren't going even that fast. We were on a road. I was behind Cindy, and I guess I just spaced out, and I wrecked, and I ripped my knee up pretty good. There's a picture of that in our second book, and I cut my knee down to the bone, actually, so you could see my kneecap.
Okay, so this is another thing. Do you carry a full first aid kit, or?
I don't know about full. We carry enough to get us a couple days of gauze and this is again, this is Cindy's department, but we carry enough stuff to get us by a couple days, assuming that we're going to hit a pharmacy or a doctor or something like that to continue. Like, so in this case, Cindy patched me up. We got into town, went to the pharmacy, and bought all kinds of disinfectant. And you can buy pretty much anything you want outside of the developed countries, you know, as far as things to fix your
pharmacy supplies.
Yeah, or antibiotics or any kind of drugs you want, things like that. We got strep throat in Mexico from being in the Mexico City pollution. Well, you just walk into the pharmacy and you get some ciprofloxacin and you just buy it for $10 a course. And, you know, you can take care of yourself a lot. We could have seen the doctor. Knowing now that we've traveled a bit, we may just go ahead and see the doctor because it's so cheap outside of the U.S. and Canada to see a doctor.
Right. Yeah, good options. So you're traveling, you're going down the road. How much do you think, how much planning should be done before the tour? In your case, it's, you know, this tour has been going on for years. But should people plan well in advance, or should they have, you know, flexible schedules? Like, you know, what do you think is the, like, I guess having an itinerary set, or is it best just to go out there and, you know, and explore and take your time?
Well, the more we travel, the less we plan. Now, that being said, there are things that have to keep you moving. Like, you got to leave the, if I was biking in Minnesota, you got to get south before winter. And if I was in southern hemisphere, so forth. There's also concerns like you may only have so many days on your visa, so you got to get through. So that may require some planning. But I think people, especially before their first trip, tend to overplan their trips and tend to, like, if you know where you're staying every night, you're not going to stick to that very long. It's just a bike is too unpredictable to predict where you're going to be.
Right. Yeah, with mileage and stuff, if you're trying to make the big mileage. Have you had some big days in mileage? Have you ever just been out and for one reason or the other, the conditions sort of maybe good weather, good conditions, you decide, hey, keep pedaling, go longer? Have you had some, like, large mileage days out there?
Well, there's definitely been days we could have rode really far. There's a big tailwind or we're dropping out of the mountains and it's a big downhill. But then something always comes along that we want to visit. There's a village we want to stay in, or there's a lady we met we want to hang out with. The two that come to mind is when we were in Argentina coming off the Altiplano into the, you know, we dropped down maybe 10, 12,000 feet. And I didn't think we rode close to 100 miles that day. I can't remember. There was another day in China when we were up in the Gobi Desert in the north near Mongolia. And it was flat and there was a very strong tailwind. And we could have rode, you know, 150 miles that day maybe. But then we get into a village and we're just too interested in poking around and meeting the people and seeing the market and things like that. There's just too much to do to spend all those hours on the bike.
Right. Which probably brings me to another question. You get into these villages, get to different destinations, like you said, it gives you a chance maybe to pause and look around and see things. In that, you know, before that sun sets, do you make time to do your blog updates? And in that, with that question, should cycle tourists carry, or not cycle tourists, cycle adventurers, should they carry laptop computers? And what about internet access? Is it everywhere? How do you get on the internet?
Well, if you want to keep a blog and you want to write a lot and you want to do a lot online, I like to carry a computer. It's quite a debate. You certainly don't have to. I mean, people biked long before there were laptop computers. But if you
Right.
plan on doing a lot online, then you really need a computer. But that doesn't mean you need to be online all the time. And that brings me to the second part of your question, is internet access. Now, when we left in 2002, internet access was few and far between. We might go 2 weeks before internet access, and we did a lot of work offline on the computer, including email and everything. And then when we connected, we sent it all, and I uploaded the website. So me personally, I like to have a computer, but I don't need to be on the internet constantly. I like to be able to, for us, it needs to be able to be done offline. So I download all my email. And then I can sit in the tent or a city park or in a hotel room even and answer my email, not on the internet. And then I can build the website, and our website has thousands of pages. And I can build all that. So when I get online, I'm not stuck writing email. I can actually upload my email, download my email, upload my website. I download a lot of podcasts. I can do a whole lot of things in an hour because I spend all the time offline getting ready to do it.
Right. That's excellent. Yeah, good planning
The
there.
new breed of these little $400 or $300 netbook computers, it's just hard to think about. Me personally, I can't imagine not having something like that because every now and then you just want to watch a movie or something, and the computer's good for that. You might listen to music, or you can have your Skype set up on it. And another big thing to be concerned about is, okay, say you don't want a computer, you're going to use all the internet cafe computers, but you don't know how secure their computers are. And there might be a
Right.
keylogger on it or something. So another big advantage that people often don't think of with having their own computer is that you know it's secure. You know the antivirus software is up to date. You know your browser is secure. You know when you log into your bank account that somebody else isn't watching and going to steal your passwords and all that. And to me, that's also very important.
Right. Excellent. Yeah, you're right. So the netbooks are, like you said, they're really inexpensive. Good alternative, saves weight. Have you ever used any solar-powered chargers at this point, or are you considering doing that when you go to India, or is it just so easy to have access to, some facility or, like you said, a hotel or something where you can charge it, or someone's home? What do you think the necessity is there for solar charging units?
When we first left, I had a 12-watt solar panel that I carried because I pictured us being out in the desert for weeks on end and having to charge my computer and stuff. But in the end, I sent it home and bought an extension cord because if you're out, let's say you are in the desert for 2 weeks, you tend to not get the computer out during that 2 weeks anyway. So you don't really need to charge it up. And then if you're ever in any kind of a town, you can charge your batteries in a laundromat. You can charge your batteries in a restaurant. Of course, if you get a hotel, you can charge batteries. So it's just too easy to charge your batteries. And if it's impossible to charge your batteries, I tend to have big batteries. So like my camera and everything, I'll have a spare battery, so my camera doesn't go dead. And I have lots of rechargeable AA batteries for my flashlight, my shortwave radio, and things like that. And then the
Right.
computer, I just don't bother with.
Okay.
I
Yeah,
have
I just don't use
extension
it.
cord, though. A small but longer extension cord comes in very handy when you're obtaining electricity in creative ways.
Right. Okay. Let's take a step forward to your books. So I mean, I hope I don't make the mistake the second time. The Road That Never Ends.
The road that has no end.
The road that has no end,
Yeah.
and down the road in South America.
I
Okay,
can
so
definitely
those.
tell which title's more catchy.
Right, being the author. So these are two great books that you've written. They're available on your website, like I've mentioned before. It's downtheroad.org. And you have a third book that's coming. How soon are you going to have the third book out there and available for people to purchase?
Probably in about 5 weeks. I mean, Cindy and I could probably argue about this a little bit, but we're flying to India in mid-March, so before that.
Right. Okay. Mid-March. Okay.
Like, again, we always believe in a flexible plan, so to give you a hard and fast due date, it was just against my nature. But I guess we have to get it done before we leave, just because that makes it logistically that's easier.
Right. Hey, Tim, where in India are you heading?
Darjeeling. Darjeeling, which is like north of Bangladesh.
Okay. I'm looking on a map here.
And just south and east of Nepal. It's near the Nepal border and near Bangladesh.
Okay. And where what direction are you heading from there?
North through Nepal.
Okay. Oh, north through Nepal. Okay. Oh, wow. I see it here. Okay. Wow, you're actually near Mount Everest then.
Yeah, and this is probably the least amount of planning we've ever done for such an exotic place. I mean, I just bought a couple guidebooks, and we looked at the weather, and we just sort of, in the dark, picked a place to start. And it just kind of shows that we just really can't bring ourselves to plan ahead, because every time we plan ahead, then the plan changes, and all that planning time you did was a waste of time. We did look at it in terms of weather. So we know it's going to be summer, and we want to be in the mountains, and so we got to be up high or far north. But after that, sky's the limit on where we go. We're going to be in the India, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, Nepal, Tibet, Pakistan. We're going to be in that area for about 4 or 5 years.
Wow. Okay, this is going to be a big, big, huge tour. Now, do you want to spend time in the Himalayas, in that area? Are you going to stay north, or are you heading directly south?
Yeah, I think India is going to be different because it gets so hot in the summer, from what I gather from the books I got, that we may have to hop around a bit instead of doing one continuous line. So in the summers, we want to be in the mountains up high, and in the winter is when we can do the southern bit of India. A lot of cyclists seem to like that. We can go to Bangladesh in the winter. We can go to Sri Lanka in the winter. And in the summer, it's the upper regions of India, the upper parts of Nepal, all of Tibet, and the upper parts of Pakistan.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds excellent. Do you have plans to you've already been through China, so, and you've actually Southeast Asia as well. You've already been down that road. Where do you think you're heading after that, or am I going too far into the future? It sounds like you're going to spend quite a bit of time in India.
Well, and after India, the only really parameter we have is we want to go somewhere we haven't been before, and we're running out of that. So what we have left is Europe and Africa and the Middle East.
Right. Okay, so you maybe just, I guess, do this tour and then decide where you're at. And I'm assuming you'll have another good book or several books coming out. How often?
We have a new editor, Alan. He's from New York, and he's really helping us keep on it and getting our books done, because when you don't have a due date, you tend to be lazier about it. But Alan's getting us with our work done. So we're going to have a number of new books coming out in the next couple years.
Okay, excellent. Okay, this has been a great interview, and I hope this turns into a fantastic podcast for people to listen to. Just to recap everything. From past touring experiences and basically turning your life into a world touring adventure, are there highlights or flashbacks, places that you'd like to visit, twice in a lifetime? Which things come up in your mind that are strong impressions from the past?
Well, I almost could go back to everywhere we've been again, but I really enjoyed China. There's something very magical and very, very foreign and exotic about China.
Right.
I liked Argentina and Chile down that way a lot because it's the pristine nature. I really enjoy Canada, and I want to cross Canada someday because I find it very clean.
Yeah, it should be good. Yeah, my plan is to, I'll be in 2012, hopefully, I'll be heading coast to coast in Canada from Vancouver, Victoria, and then up into the Rockies. Up to Banff, and then over, probably back down to Edmonton, and then across the prairies. Yeah, it's definitely beautiful touring. I think some of the roads are a bit dangerous. Probably the most dangerous stretch of the Trans-Canada is in Manitoba, because the if you're on the Trans-Canada Highway, I don't think they have a shoulder on the road. It's actually gravel.
Yeah, well, everywhere has its hard roads and stuff, but being Canadian, you'll never have seen your own country till you've ridden across it.
Right, and that I haven't done yet, so I'm definitely looking forward to it. And so, Tim, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time. This has been a really informative and very interesting interview. Is there anything else you'd like to say to kind of sign off?
Not really. I just want to thank everybody for supporting us and sending us kind emails through the years. There's quite a number of people that subscribe to our email list and our RSS feed and things like that. And all the people who bought our books through the years. But just want to thank everybody for thinking of us and helping us out.
Right. Excellent. Well, keep the rubber side down, and good luck on your next expedition over there in India.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Brian, and we'll be looking forward to following your trip.
Right. Excellent. Okay, Tim. Well, thanks. And so that concludes our podcast. And everyone, thank you for listening in. And hopefully down the road, it's actually downtheroad.org, we can catch Tim and Cindy Travis and find out more about their adventures as they continue in March in India.
Okay, thank you.